Our Chantunnel, I rise at this time to introduce my co-counsel, Edward Shapiro of Latham & Watkins in the District of Columbia Bar. He will he's been admitted for Hawk Beach and will present argument on behalf of the Appalee Liberty Property.
Hey, welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Dan Dreisbach from Richards Latham Finger on behalf of Appellant 25 Mass. With me from Williams & Connolly is Ryan Scarborough and Paul Wolf. Mr. Wolf will be presenting argument on behalf of the appellant.
Mr. Wolf, welcome to the court.
Thank you.
And did the clerk explain to you our light system?
She did.
Very well.
May I proceed?
Yes, please.
Your Honors, over the decades, the case law, the treatises, the horn books, the restatement, have uniformly held that when a party pursues a breach of contract suit, and when that party loses, and if in pursuit of that lawsuit, that losing party interferes with the other party's contract rights, it must pay the price. That you assume the risk that when two parties to a contract at war with each other, each claiming breach, if the losing party in pursuit of its breach damages the other party's contractual rights, it must bear the adverse effects. In fact, just a few months before we tried this case, before Vice Chancellor Strine, he held in the Intel case that the losing plaintiff claiming breach bore the risk of the damage it caused to the defendant's contract rights. And it's important that I read into the record exactly what the Vice Chancellor stated. He said, a party acts at its peril if insisting on what he mistakenly believes to be his rights, he refuses to perform his duty. Notwithstanding that holding, and notwithstanding the fact that repeatedly in our pleadings and our oral arguments, we brought this case to Vice Chancellor Strine's attention, never once in his opinion did he recognize its existence or make any attempt to distinguish it or tell us why it was not applicable to our case. I submit it is. I submit when Republic, now Liberty, inadvisedly, incorrectly, pursued its suit for specific performance, that when it lost, it bore the burden, it acted at its peril, and it was liable to my client for the interference in my client 25 Mass's opportunity to sell this property.
What does your position effectively write out of the contract the right to bring this specific performance action?
Absolutely not. What it does, it says, you can bring a suit for specific performance. And had they brought a suit, for example, for specific performance, and had we not sold the property, there would have been no damage. There would have been no interference. There is nothing that prevents them from bringing a suit. The catchphrase that bringing a breach of contract suit is not a breach of contract is not what we are saying. What we are saying is, if you bring the suit and if you lose, as in the Intel case, you interfere with the other party's rights, you must bear the burden. It is basically saying that the party that has the right view of the contract collects the damages it suffered, that we have rights under the contract, and if we were right in fighting off their suit and we've been damaged, we should collect. It is basically saying there's no free lunch. Now, Vice Chancellor Strine recognized that we had a right for 180 days to sell this property. He calls it specifically a right in his opinion. And in the very beginning of his opinion, he talks about the fact, and I use his word, freedom, that we had the freedom to sell the building to the highest bidder if the first option had lapsed, which it did. In fact, Mr. Keller, who was the CEO of Republic, now Liberty, testified at trial that the second option was a negotiated agreement that my client, 25 Mass, if the first option lapsed, wanted an opportunity before it was locked in for another 2 years, the opportunity to sell the property, to take its profits and run, to cut its losses, to stop the bleeding, the negative cash flow. So we had a right, and that right was interfered with when they clouded our title and prevented 25 Mass from selling the property. We had a binding contract, which after four extensions only had one out, and that single out was if we couldn't deliver clean title, the buyer could walk. And we couldn't deliver clean title, although we tried through considerable negotiations with the other side to be in a position to deliver clean title. We couldn't, and that's what killed our sale, and that's what led to our damages. Now, the Vice Chancellor said, and he recognized that we had a right, but he said, you also had to have in the contract a provision that basically said that if they interfere with your right, they have to pay. If they bring an unsuccessful breach of contract suit, they have to pay your damages. First of all, I submit that type of clause is unnecessary because the law, including his own Intel decision, tells people when they bring lawsuits. The law says you proceed at your own peril, you proceed at your own risk. So there was no need in the contract to tell Republic that it proceeded at its own risk if it damaged our rights.
Is this a backdoor way to the English rule, loser pays in every contract case?
The rule is, in the English rule, is that loser pays legal fees. This is not a case that I'm arguing before you about legal fees. We are not talking about the English rule or the American rule on legal fees. We are talking about contract damages. We are talking about the fact that they interfered with our ability to sell this property. If we want to pursue contract damages, as the Universal case in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals points out, which just came out last week, which we submitted to the court, that to get legal fees under the D.C. sanctions law, there is a certain test. But that has nothing to do with the pursuit of a contract action. We are not backdooring anything. If we want to get legal fees, we will pursue the legal fees. We are before this court seeking compensatory damages for the loss we suffered when they interfered with our 180-day period to sell this property. And I point out that we've asked for consistency from the Vice Chancellor, that he look upon our claim for breach as he looked upon their claim for breach. When he addressed their claim for breach, there was a condition proceeding. That condition proceeding said, if the property is leased to 85%, then the option kicks in and they get the opportunity to buy the property. That condition proceeding, if it's leased to 85%, Vice Chancellor Strine held to be a right for Republic. He held that they had the right to see that property leased 85% without our interference. And the whole thrust of their case is that we had breached the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and seeing that the 85% was not reached, that we had been unreasonable in looking at a lease they proffered, which would have satisfied the 85%. So the Vice Chancellor looked at their side of the case and said, did my client interfere with the condition proceeding so as to kill the option? And I submit our side of the case should be looked at the same way. Did they interfere with our right to sell the property so as to get the second option? Just as we couldn't engage in conduct to kill the first option, they could not engage in conduct to assure the getting of the second option. And I point out, Republic sold itself to Liberty. That ended the option agreement. Had there not been a sale, a change of control, if you take Vice Chancellor Strine's ruling and affirm it, there would be today the existence of the second option. They would be sitting on a second option because they had killed the 180-day opportunity to sell. And thus, we would have basically lost any period to unload this property. They would have, by their actions, basically eliminated the condition preceding, and they would have had automatically the second option. And we would have no contractual right under Vice Chancellor Strine's ruling to go as a matter of contract law against them. They would be sitting on a second option, and we would have no recourse.
Mr. Wolf,
yes, Your Justice.
During the course of the trial, I gather that there was evidence in the record about the efforts that your client made to basically work out some arrangement under which the other side's rights would be preserved, yet your client would be able to sell the property. The briefs refer to an attempt to get some sort of an escrow of the funds, and there may have been some other proposal that was made, and both of those were turned down. I gather all of that was established in the trial record?
Yes, Your Honor. What we did, there is a provision 8C which provides that each side will engage in best efforts to help the other side accomplish its rights under the agreement. And what we did is we approached them basically asking them to mitigate their damages. And we said under 8C, we're asking you to mitigate your damages so that we can sell the property, we'll put all the money in escrow, and you then would have a contract action for your damages as opposed to specific performance. We tried, we went back and forth, that was never successful. We also asked that we have an expedited trial so that the trial would have occurred prior to the time our buyer walked and they turned down or opposed our effort for an expedited trial. But we tried to approach them in a way that would guarantee their recovery. In fact, as I said, put the money in escrow, but would also minimize or mitigate the damages they caused by preventing us from completing the sale.
And I believe that you told us a few minutes ago that there was only one contractual out at the time that the buyer-to-be walked, and that was the covenant to deliver full title.
Yes, that is.
Was there trial testimony to the effect that the only reason that the other party to the contract walked was the list pendants that has not been lifted.
Yes, yes. We called the representative of the purchaser, the person with whom we negotiated, with whom we struck the deal, and his deposition was taken, and that was entered into the evidence at trial, and he said they would have closed, there would have been a deal, but for the inability to deliver title. This man's name is David Hill, and that is in the record of this case, that when it came to the, I think, I don't know whether it's the third or fourth extension, but by the time it came to either the last or the penultimate extension, everything had been focused down on the one single out, and that was that there is either clean title or there's not clean title. And the title company told us they would not deliver clean title as long as not only the lease pendant stood, but as long as they pursued specific performance.
You referred to provision 8C. Was an alleged breach of 8C litigated before?
Yes. We brought both an express breach of contract and an implied breach of contract claim.
And what was the Vice Chancellor's ruling on 8C?
There's no discussion of it. It's not addressed.
So it wasn't the sticking point wasn't just the list pendants. It was also the underlying suit.
Yes.
Consequently, I gather, even if the other side had been willing to withdraw the list pendants notice, that would not have improved the situation from your client's standpoint.
No. The title company made it clear that this had to be converted to a lawsuit for damages. And that's why we offered to put the money in escrow.
Well, even without the list pendants, once they had actual notice of the suit for specific performance, you weren't going to get a clear title.
That's correct. That's correct. As I said, we went back and forth with the title company, ad infinitum, maybe ad nauseum, and we ultimately were told, look, if you want to deliver this property, you want clean title, clear title, you have to convert this to a suit for damages, and that's why we agreed to take all the proceeds and put it in escrow.
You're into the time you reserved. You can continue. Or would
no,
you like-
I'm going to stop now and just make one final comment, and that is under the universal case, under contract law, the notion of bad faith being an issue in this case, I submit is simply irrelevant. You made it clear, this court, in the Duncan case, that bad faith and lack of good faith and fair dealing are not equals. And our case is based either upon the express contract term under 8C or the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court.
Good morning.
I'd like to address first the principal argument on which 25 Mass relies and for which there is absolutely no case support in the American common law, least of all in the District of Columbia, whose law governs this case. And that is their fundamental argument that there is some sort of doctrine exposing litigants who sue for breach of contract to damages if they sue for breach of contract and then lose. There is no such rule, and they assert that that's the duty. But the deficiency of their argument is revealed by what the cases they rely on actually say, and in particular the Intel case, which they emphasize in their briefs and which Mr. Wolf addresses here. And let me talk about the cases generally and then specifically about the Intel case. In each of the cases they offer, the breach that was found arose from a failure of the breaching party to perform an underlying duty in the contract, not some duty not to litigate, not some duty that had anything to do with litigation, but an underlying duty. They failed to pay money. They failed to provide promised financing. They failed in some other form of garden variety contract performance, as in the Intel case. The Intel case, which Vice Chancellor Strine decided, dealt with a party contracting with Intel to develop encryption processing chips for a $2 million fee. That party was held in breach not because it sued for breach of contract. There was a debate about whether there was a repudiation and who breached the contract. What gave rise to liability in that case, as in all of the cases on which 25 Mass relies, was not the act of litigation, but the underlying failure to perform within a reasonable time. What the Vice Chancellor said on page one of that opinion is that HIFN, the party that was held liable, quote, failed to perform within a reasonable time and thus committed a total breach of the contract on that basis. The litigation had nothing to do with it. In fact, in each of the cases on which 25 Mass relies, the breach would have been complete and just as complete had no litigation been brought at all.
Mr. Shapiro, excuse me for interrupting. Tell us what you understand to be the precise issue that we need to decide.
As to this particular argument, Your Honor, I think the precise issue that needs to be decided is whether there is a doctrine of law exposing plaintiffs in breach of contract cases to liability for breach of contract if they lose the underlying litigation and, as a collateral consequence of that litigation, some injury arises to the defendant. That is the simple they say in their opening brief at 23, Republic should be responsible for any damages caused by the fact that it filed a lawsuit that did not succeed.
Well, I'm thrown by your reference to liability for breach of contract. As I understand it, the claim here is a tort claim for interference with a contract.
They've never pleaded that, and they've waived it.
So your statement of the issue isn't responsive to their argument, at least as I understand what you said.
Well, all of the cases on which they rely are breach of contract cases. What they say, and it is hard to grapple with because there's a paucity of case law for it, because as Mr. Wolf implicitly acknowledged in his argument, they seek to go beyond the English rule. And forget about the difference between the American rule and the English rule. They seek to go beyond it and say that a losing litigant is exposed as a matter of contract duty, that it breaches a contract duty to sue for breach of contract if you lose, and if in the course of asserting that claim, the defendant, if in the course of the plaintiff's assertion and litigation of that claim, the fact of that litigation causes some injury.
Okay, so the claim here is that the conduct by your client constituted, I gather, under District of Columbia substantive law,
a breach.
An interference with a contract right. Your response is there's no authority for that proposition, and the authorities that are cited don't involve an interference claim.
I think I see the confusion. They assert it. They should be, if they had a claim, they should be asserting it as a tort. They should be asserting it as the tort of interference. They never pleaded that. They acknowledge in their briefs, and I'll get the page cite later in my argument, they acknowledge in their briefs that they're not pleading a tort claim. They're not pleading bad faith. They've never argued bad faith. They waived any argument that they might have made concerning bad faith by avowing to the trial court in the post-trial briefs, and this is cited in our brief at page 32 and in the appendix.
You're saying that the theory that's being presented to us wasn't pleaded below?
Wasn't pleaded or argued. They never pleaded.
It wasn't argued before the vice chancellor in the post-trial submissions?
In fact, they vociferated to the vice chancellor that they were not asserting or taking on the burden of proving a tort claim of any kind.
Well, aren't they saying it wasn't simply that you were asserting a contract position, but that what your client did actually constituted a breach in and of itself?
That's what they're saying.
That's their position.
That is their only position, and that is their position. That's correct.
Yep. What's your reading on 8C?
Now, the Further Assurances Clause, which is 8C, is typical of many Further Assurances clauses. It certainly doesn't provide any express language. It doesn't include any express language overriding Section 14K, in which the right to sue for specific performance is expressly recognized and recognized without any limits. You know, the gap period here is no different from the lapse of any other option. I mean, it's a right, a reserved right, the same way there's a reserved right any time there's an option agreement that is time limited. When the option lapses, the right to sell or dispose of the property reverts to the owner. Same thing here. It's certainly foreseeable, it happens all the time, that if there is a if there's a dispute toward the end of the option term, litigation for specific performance concerning whether the option is exercisable may spill over into the period beyond the option term, into the period in which it lapses. We cited a case at page 26 of our brief where that period lasted 3 years after the option was after the option had expired. So it's certainly foreseeable. And
so,
yet
the way I try to reconcile these positions that seem to be argued is they assert they had a right to sell the property. You assert you had a right to bring specific performance. They contend if your right to bring specific performance defeated their right to sell the property, you should be responsible. Your response is, no, we had competing rights. Once they were adjudicated, the chips just fell where they may.
Well, that's. Let me continue and express further detail in our position. Certainly those rights and the competition between them existed. I mean, there's a tension. They have their rights, as in any option. They have their rights after the option expires, and we have our rights to exercise the option, and they may be disputed. The contract dealt with how that tension is resolved, dealt with the hierarchy of our rights, by providing expressly that we could sue for specific performance, and not in the face of the foreseeable possibility that there would be a dispute toward the end of the option term. That's usually
when... Well, but Mr. Wolf said your right was to proceed at your peril to the extent you defeated his client's right. That's really where we are, isn't it?
That's what he says. But the contract, and what he's saying is that you should imply into the contract a duty to stop your suit for specific performance at the point where they have a potential sale once the option lapses, whether it's in the gap period or after the option lapses entirely. Because the language of Section 14K, which is so specific and explicit and unlimited, provides for a right to sue for specific performance, doesn't say you have to stop. It would be easy to say this. In fact, it would be important to say it, because the presumption of a right to sue for specific performance is that you can maintain your suit until it's resolved. It would be important to say you can't maintain it if we get a sale. You can't maintain it if we come to you with some proposal to give up, as they did with their escrow proposal, give up your right to specific performance, agree, as you did not when the contract was signed, that your only remedy will be for damages.
Well, that was the whole purpose of your suit, was to make sure it didn't get sold to anyone else, wasn't it?
The purpose of the suit was to buy the property under the option, which obviously has the collateral effect of ensuring, I mean, only one party can buy it, so it also has the effect.
Well, if you only wanted damages, you wouldn't care if they sold it to someone else. But once your suit is for specific performance, the purpose you're trying to accomplish is for you to be the owner of that property and no one else.
That's precisely correct, and that was a right the contract reserved to us to seek.
Now, did the Vice Chancellor expressly address whether that specific performance action violated the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
He did in one way and not in another, and let me explain what the two ways are so that I can draw that distinction. The covenant of good faith and fair dealing can only help them in two ways. First, it can serve as the foundation to imply into the contract a term that it does not contain. In other words, to imply limits on Section 14K permitting us to sue specific performance, even though 14K doesn't include those limits and it was foreseeable that the limits should be provided if the parties had wanted to cabin that right. So in the face, I mean, there is no District of Columbia authority, nor any in any of the 50 states that I've found, that says that if a contract says that a party can do X, the court will imply into it limits that the contract is not contained on that party's rights to do X and say, well, not in this circumstance, you can't do X. The other way, and the Vice Chancellor addressed that and said, there's no right. I've read the contract carefully, including the provisions on which you rely, and not only is there no express covenant not to sue, there's an expressly granted right to sue for specific performance. And in the face of that right, your effort to imply into the contract a contrary spirit fails. The Vice Chancellor addressed that squarely in almost those terms in his memorandum opinion at about pages 46 to 49. Well, now the other...
And what implications, if any, are there for this case as a result of the most recent case from D.C.?
Oh, the Liz Pendens case?
Yes.
I think there are none. I just want to come back to the second half of Justice Ridgely's question, so I'll answer this first. But that case has no bearing on this one. That's a case addressing the standards for relief under the district's Liz Pendens statute. The interesting thing about the Liz Pendens statute is that it includes a standard that is so demanding that 25 Mass disavowed in the trial court that it was making any claim under that statute either. And later, earlier this week, the District of Columbia Court of Appeals decided that a litigant seeking sanctions, not damages, it doesn't provide for damages, but sanctions under the Liz Pendens statute doesn't have to prove bad faith as such. What it has to prove is essentially a Rule 11 standard that would satisfy an obligation, the obligation you would have to meet in order to be awarded sanctions. So it has no implications for this case because 25 Mass has made no such claim. If I may return to the second half of the good faith and fair dealing argument, and Justice Ridgely, you asked what, if any, did the trial court address the good faith and fair dealing argument? And I said the court did address why a covenant not to sue can't be implied into the contract. It also addressed, although in very summary fashion, the second half of the only way they could get there under the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, because the good covenant does say in the context, and restatement section 205 comment E says this, in the context of the assertion and litigation of contract claims, the covenant of good faith and fair dealing can be breached if the party bringing the claim and asserting the claim lacks a belief in its own position or proceeds through dishonest litigation conduct, neither of which was found. And the reason, there are two reasons that the trial court didn't find that. The most important one, and the one that is dispositive here, is that 25 Mass not only didn't argue that that standard was satisfied, it said the same thing Mr. Wolf said in his argument here, which is that's not in the case. We're not taking on the burden of proving bad faith. We're not arguing bad faith.
Well, those two elements that you just addressed on good faith and fair dealing, did the Vice Chancellor discuss those?
He didn't discuss them. He didn't detail them. But the reason he didn't and shouldn't have been expected to, other than, I mean, he decided that aspect of the case, that there was no bad faith, as though it was a foregone conclusion. Here's why he did that. In their post-trial opening brief, you know, after having said before trial, in their pretrial, let me start with their pretrial brief. There's a history here. He said, the 25 Mass said with respect to its counterclaims in their pretrial reply brief, quote, contrary to Republic's suggestion, 25 Mass does not have to prove bad faith in order to recover for breach of contract claim, close quote. And they're saying that in the context of not presenting any argument or marshaling any evidence that would support a finding of bad faith. Then in post-trial colloquy, the Vice Chancellor, and this is cited, these pages are cited in our brief at page 32, the Vice Chancellor said, these are partial quotes, but the context is fair, you have not convinced me that they acted in bad faith at all, and it ain't going to get close to that. You're never made exactly whole if you get sued and prevail unless you show that the other side suing was in bad faith, essentially Rule 11. Counsel for 25 Mass. We will address in our brief the fact that we have a belief we don't have to show bad faith. We say we don't have to show bad faith to prove that they interfered with our contract right. So they disavowed before the Vice Chancellor at argument any argument of bad faith, which is the burden they have to meet to prove a covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim in the context of litigating disputed claims.
Well, your opponent cites the Duncan case for bad faith does not equal lack of good faith and fair dealing. Are you going to respond to that?
Yes. The governing standard for a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing in the in a setting involving a suit for breach of contract is set forth in Restatement Section 205, Comment E. It's the one I've read. It's the one that's cited in our briefs. They've never responded to it. They've ignored that standard. They ignored it in their reply brief. They obviously ignored it in their opening brief, and they've ignored it in argument today. That is the governing standard. And if it weren't, you would see there would be cases saying that a party who proffered an interpretation of a contract and lost was liable for the covenant of good faith, a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. They haven't cited a single case in any of their briefs in which the outcome, in which the issue was whether a party asserting a breach of contract had committed a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing by so doing, let alone one that would support their position. And what they said, and they went on to distance themselves from any claim of bad faith by saying in their post-trial opening brief, their post-trial brief, at page one, bad faith has no place in this case. For that reason, 25 Mass neither pleaded nor tried to prove bad faith. They also said a few pages later, 25 Mass assiduously avoided offering evidence at trial concerning bad faith. I mean, that's a remarkably strong disavowal of any such claim. I submit that under this Court's Rule 8, any such claim has long been waived. But in any event, the reason that the Vice Chancellor addressed it so summarily derives most importantly from the fact that they had disavowed it. Part of the reason they disavowed it was there was no evidence, nor is there any suggestion in the Vice Chancellor's opinion, that Republic lacked a belief in the merits of its position, was proceeding for some purpose other than to try to buy the building, or had committed dishonest conduct in the litigation. They made a motion trying to get evidence of dishonest conduct belatedly into what they said was evidence of dishonest conduct into the record on appeal, and that motion was properly rejected procedurally. I'll forbear from commenting on its merits. So with respect to the two sides of the coin question, whether good faith and bad faith are two sides of the same coin and there's no gap in between them. In the context of breach of contract litigation under the restatement, which the district follows, in contract litigation, there is no breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing absent the kind of bad faith set forth in the restatement. I mean, they articulate the kinds of bad faith that would satisfy the standard for such a claim. 25 Mass, there's no suggestion of it in the memorandum opinion. 25 Mass doesn't really, certainly didn't argue it at trial, doesn't really argue responsibly to the standard here because all of their arguments go to some other kind of conduct than that which would satisfy the standard in the restatement. In summary, all of the duties that 25 Mass asserts are unsupported by any case precedent from any state, let alone from the District of Columbia. They seek to establish a rule at odds with American common law that simply breaching a contract and losing creates liability. And that's why, in response to Justice Jacobs' question, it really should have been pleaded if they had meant to pursue it as a tort claim, because contract law does not provide a remedy for the simple assertion of contract rights when the litigant does not prevail.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I have to move really quick. First of all, Section 14 on the right of specific performance, let me read into the record exactly what that says. In the event that seller or purchaser fails to perform any of their obligations, the non-defaulting party shall be entitled to exercise all remedies available to the non-defaulting party, including the remedy of specific performance. We are the non-defaulting party. They are the ones whom we claim breached. We didn't breach this contract. Vice Chancellor Strine held emphatically in 47 pages that we were the non-defaulting party. Secondly, Your Honors, I was asked to say, what case provides that the covenant of good faith and fair dealing does not require bad faith. We have recited throughout this litigation the Howard University case from the District of Columbia Court of Appeals that specifically follows this court's holding in Duncan and says that lack of good faith or fair dealing does not equal bad faith. It says lack of good faith and fair dealing is interfering with the other party's rights, preventing them from getting the full benefits of their rights under this contract.
Mr. Wolf, we are told that the theory that you've argued to us, tortious interference, was not a theory that was pleaded or asserted before the Vice Chancellor. What is your response?
I am not arguing tortious interference. If I argued tortious interference, I would have to come up with a higher standard than the breach of contract standard. I am arguing breach of contract. Here's the case in a nutshell, and I want to get it out. It's very simple. The first option lapsed. So let's look at this case. We had 180 days to sell. If we didn't sell with 180 days, they got another option. They interfered with our right during that 180 days to sell. That is a contract breach. It is nothing else. We had a right. They deprived us of that right. And how they deprived it, whether it was by bringing litigation.
Wolf, sorry, your time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Wolf, Mr. Shapiro, thank you for your arguments. The court finds them helpful. We'll take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.